I think some time ago we spoke about the idea of Shabbos, Shabbat, and the mitzvah of Shabbos and what it means. Well, there's one peculiar sounding idea, that we haven't discussed before, and that is that there's an idea that on Shabbat one gets an extra soul. Extra soul? That's called a Shomer Yisrael, an extra soul. What is the meaning of this strange-sounding idea? What does an extra soul mean? Where does it come from? What major principle can we derive from it? Let's try to think through this together. Some people think that the extra soul is like a schizoid sort of a thing. You get two souls, right? That's why you have to eat extra on Shabbos, because you've got to feed the other soul. That's not right. There's no schizoid two people inside you on Shabbos, at least not any more than during the week. So what is the meaning of this extra soul? Maybe an interesting way to introduce it is there's a tefillah prayer that we say on Shabbos, which has a challenging sequence. Shabbat morning, and every on a festival as well, on a Yom Tov, we say Nishmas Kol Chai. This has been described as extremely or uniquely poetic, and we say this only on Shabbos. In a normal weekday, we don't say this prayer. Nishmas Kol Chai, the soul of all that lives. The word neshama, which begins it, nishmat kol chai, that's a noteworthy. Now we'll try and explain this. It doesn't say nefesh, which is the normal word for a living being or for a human being. It says neshama. Neshama is something much higher. Try to understand what this means. But the problematic sequence is this. It says this. Ilu finu malei shira. If our mouths were filled with song, kayam, like the ocean, ulshonenu rina, and our tongues were like the ocean waves, and our lips were filled with praise like the expanse of the heavens, and our eyes shone like the sun. I mean, very, very expansive powers, right? And like the moon. And our hands were spread like eagle's wings, and our feet could run like deer. In other words, if we had the control and the power of the whole universe at our disposal, and we tried to use that to relate to Hashem, we wanted to talk about God's greatness and His might and His power and so forth, and we try to apply all of that universal power to that enterprise, how close would we get to being able to express Hashem's greatness? Eina nachnu maspikim, we would not manage, lohedus lacha Hashem alokenu, to praise you, or thank you. How far would we fall short? Al achas me'alef elef alfei alofim, v'ribei revavavus, which means, loosely translated, on one part in a thousand, millionth, trillionth, zillionth, 10,000 times, zillionth, trillionth, etc., more or less. Right? I mean, it's a very unusual sequence. We wouldn't manage 1,000th of a thousandth of a thousand, 10,000, I mean, it goes on and on, right? We wouldn't be able to, and the reason is, of course, that if we had the power of the universe at our disposal, it wouldn't begin to relate to the infinite, no matter how big the universe is. You know, the modern theory of the universe is that it's finite. Right? The universe is finite. In fact, in modern physics, the universe is considered to be finite but endless. Finite but endless. How can you have something that's finite and endless? Yes, no?
Because the term universe is used to define everything that exists.
That sounds very deep, but how does that answer the question? So I'll tell you what they say in modern physics. They say there is a shape that is finite and endless. If you picture the universe as having the shape of the surface of a balloon. The surface of a balloon is certainly finite, but it's endless. There's no end on the surface of a sphere. That's the concept. But be that as it may, the universe is a finite thing. It certainly contains finite entities. And therefore, if you're as expansive as the universe, and you try to apply that universal power to Hashem's greatness, you wouldn't begin an inexpressibly small fraction of the job. Because no matter how big a finite thing is, it's nothing compared to the infinite. Make sense? Yes? No? Anyone out there? Does this make sense? Do I need to say it again? That's the idea. Three lines later we say this. Alkain, therefore, Evarim Shipulak Tabanu, the limbs and organs that you've given us, and the Ruach and the Neshama that you breathed into us, and the tongue that you put in our mouth, the very same organs that we just complained about as being unable to do the job, they will do the job. They'll praise you and sing your greatness and so forth. Three lines before you said that it's impossible to begin, that if you had all the power of the universe at your disposal, you wouldn't manage an infinitesimal fraction of the job. Three lines later you say, we'll do it. Contradiction? Problem? So there are a number of answers to this. One classic answer that's attributed to a number of sources is, which is a uniquely and typically Jewish answer, is it's impossible, but that's irrelevant. We'll do it anyway. In other words, a Jew doesn't ask, the great Balaam Musa say, don't ask if a thing is possible. Ask only if it's necessary. It's not your job to worry about what's possible. All you have to worry about in life is it's necessary. If a job is necessary, do it. Possible, impossible, that's his problem, not yours. And therefore, the job is impossible, but you're here to relate to Hashem. You're here not to be stuck to the finite dimension of the world. You are here to transcend the finite dimension of the world and to expand and elevate yourself. And therefore, you have to relate to infinity. And therefore, the fact that it's impossible is irrelevant. Just do it. That's one answer. But I'd like to suggest to you a deeper answer, which can take us a long way. And that is that this tefillah, this prayer of Nishmas, this is the tefillah of the Neshama Yesera. This is the prayer of the extra soul of Shabbos. And that's why this prayer has to be said on Shabbos. In fact, we say it every day when the Gemara makes it clear that we have this extra soul dimension. Right? The days when we don't have it, we don't say it, and the days when we do say it. And in fact, it's essential to say. If you come late, for example, on Shabbos morning, right, to shul, which of course I'm sure you'd never consider doing. But if you did come late, this is something you can't omit. You can omit a lot of the rest of Sukkot Zimra, the introductory part of the Shabbos morning tefillah. You can omit that if necessary, certain parts. This part you cannot omit because it's an essential part of the tefillah. And the key is, this is the prayer of the Neshama Yesera. And the secret, amazing secret is that the meaning of Neshama Yesera is that this extra soul is not another soul. But what it is, it's a deeper reach of soul into the body. The secret of Neshama Yesera is that there's a more potent expression. That means the sanctity, the Kedusha, the elevated component of the human being. On Shabbos, amazingly, the beginner might think that on Shabbos it floats higher. But amazingly, the concept is it comes in lower. That means that this extra dimension of soul means a greater penetration of soul into the body than you have on a weekday. And the secret is that when you have that extra dose of soul, then the body can do infinite things. On a normal weekday, if you would take the lips and tongue and all the organs that we spoke about, and you try to use them to reach into an infinite dimension, it would be extremely difficult. You wouldn't manage an infinitesimal part of that. But on Shabbos, amazingly, those same bodily organs are connected to the spiritual world in a uniquely powerful way, to the extent that they can do a job that reaches into the infinite. What does this mean? Sounds very peculiar. But the theme is this. And really, I think there's no more basic or unique theme in Judaism than this, because really, this idea that the body is capable of sanctity, or that the finite element of the body can be used to reach into an infinite dimension, as far as I'm aware, Judaism is the only path on earth that takes that line. Now let's explore that, try to understand. The history of this idea is that when the world was formed originally, the two dimensions of soul and body were formed in perfect harmony. This is part of a much broader pattern that's known in the Kabbalistic writing as lights and vessels. The world was formed with two currents of energy, two domains, lights and vessels. Everything that exists in the world, the way it's put in some Kabbalistic sources, is that everything has a father and a mother. Father always means light, mother always means vessel. Right? You see that in many ways. Maleness is always a spiritual dimension of infinite potential. Femaleness is always a finite expression of that infinite potential. Many, many examples. One obvious example is, whenever we refer to Hashem, we talk about God, we tend to speak in the male. We refer to God as male. Right? The reason we do that isn't because we are, you know, chauvinist, anti-feminist, medieval, you know, women-hating, you know, narrow-minded. That's not the reason. The reason is because maleness means infinite potential. And female means finite expression of potential. In Hebrew, all the words for the earth, for example, are feminine. All the words for vessels are feminine. Right? For example, even the word Adama is a feminine word. It means the earth. The word for Eretz, which means the world, is also a feminine word, even though you wouldn't know it looking at the word. All expression, practical expression, is feminine. The woman is the vessel. Right? Hashem's presence creates a world. The first manifestation in the world is called Genesis, Bereishis. It begins with a base. Base means two. And it means vessel. Base means the house. The woman is the home. The Talmud says that the great sages called their wives their home. A sage would refer to his wife. He wouldn't say my wife, he'd say my home. She was the home. Why? She gave him a place. This is why the bride walks seven times around the groom. That means, you know the symbol of the chuppah? He takes her into his domain when you get married. The chasen takes the color under the chuppah, which is a symbol of his home. But she walks around him to show you, I'm entering your home, but I give you a place to be. That's what it means. Yeah. To say that she walks around him, that's the place where he exists. She gives him the place to be, and she gives him the practical expression. You know, the world is formed, the most basic element of the world is always called, the most basic element of the world is the stones and rocks that form the world. The Torah says that the world was formed from a rock of formation. That's called Even Shsia, Even, the rock from which creation spread. The word rock, or stone in Hebrew, which always means the building block, the essential building block, like it says, Even Ma'asu Abonim, the rock that the builders rejected became the cornerstone of the building. That's what King David said about himself. By the way, David is regarded as feminine. Amazing. King David is regarded as the female counterpart. That means he's the seventh. The bride walks seven times around the groom. He's the seventh character that comes to the world and manifests the completion of the project, which is considered to be the female end. But a stone is the ultimate root building block of the world. The word Even in Hebrew is feminine. Actually, it's amazing. The word Even is a contraction of two words in Hebrew, Av and Ben, which means father and son. When you melt together the two words, father and son, in Hebrew, you get the word Even, and it means woman. It's feminine. Because she is the place where father transmits to son. She gives that a form. That's the idea. The Hebrew word for female, the word nekeva in Hebrew, meaning female, literally means to make specific. To make limited and specific, like you say, Nakva Schalchala, fix your wages and I'll pay you. Right? Like Yaakov, Laban said to Yaakov, he said, give me a figure and I'll pay you. You want a salary? Give me a figure. You know what that means? Maleness is, imagine a person says to you, give me a figure and I'll pay you. Say any number, you can have that much money. Say any number, you can have that much money. What happens? Two things. One is the numbers start rolling. But the paradox is, until you say a number, you have nothing. The potential number gets more and more and more, but it's worthless. As soon as you say a figure, which is the female expression, two things happen. One is you get the money. Two, not a penny more. Total limitation. By the way, you know that male and female personalities are like that. If you say to a man, give me a figure, he won't say a figure, he'll just keep. That's maleness. It's the reason young men don't really want to get married, because as soon as you present them with a marriage option, they keep thinking to themselves, what, you know, there's millions out there. I get married, I'll have just one. So you'd rather have none. Because maleness is the fantasy of potential. And femaleness is the bringing down to the specific. That's a common theme. And therefore, the lights are infinite, the vessels are finite. The vessel can only hold as much light as the vessel is able to hold. And the world, when it was formed originally, was a paradox of amazing harmony between an infinite light and a finite vessel. Actually, according to the Kabbalistic tradition, When the lights originally went into the vessels broke. Obviously. Obviously. You've tried to put an infinite light into finite vessels, the vessels broke. That's the famous idea of the breaking of the vessels. I'm sure you're all accomplished Kabbalists and you know about this. The breaking of the vessels that happened before the world was created was the result. And then, of course, the creation represented a correction of the vessels, a reconstruction of the vessels, until the world was formed with a perfect harmony of infinite light inside a finite vessel. What did it look like in the human realm? The whole world looked that way. But if you looked at a human being who was formed that way, you found a being who had a body that was so elevated that it was no contradiction to the light. The human body was so elevated before the sin, before man sinned, that an infinite soul could shine within it and be no contradiction. One way to grasp this, many ways to approach this, but one way to grasp it is, why does the Torah say that they wore no clothes? What's the Torah telling us that they wore no clothes and were not ashamed? What does that mean? The reason we wear clothing is because our light, namely our soul, in our body, is such a humiliating discrepancy. The two are so opposite that we feel shame. Shame is always generated by a treachery. Whenever there's a traitor, a treachery, that means if one is completely inwardly the same as one is outwardly, there can be no sense of shame. The only reason you feel ashamed is because you're not manifesting what you really are. The reason you feel ashamed without clothes is because you stand without clothes and look at yourself in the mirror. What is the sense of humiliation? If you have any refinement, you feel that. What's the reason? The reason is that you have an angelic inner being in a body that looks like a horse. At best. And that's humiliating. That's humiliating. The outward manifestation of the body, which is exactly the same as a naked animal, is inappropriate for a human soul. And so we cover that nakedness to show dignity. In fact, when man originally sinned, he felt that shame, so he took a leaf to cover himself. Only a leaf, just to cover the most undignified aspect of what he had used to sin. And God appeared in the world and said, "You're making a mistake. I'm going to teach you a fundamental spiritual principle." And this principle runs throughout the whole Torah, and it should run throughout all of life. Whenever you fail in the world, take the problem and make it the solution. If you take the problem, your defeat, and you make that the victory, then you've corrected the defeat. If you take a problem and you move on, you leave the problem behind you. You leave it unreconstructed, and you move on. So then you've done well. But there's a part that's always broken. If you take the problem and make that the solution, then not only are you whole, but there's nothing broken left behind. This is the deep idea of Tchias HaMesim. Tchias HaMesim is resurrection of the dead. It doesn't mean that dead people get up from their graves and walk on. The deep concept of the resurrection is that everything that died lives. That every failed opportunity and broken relationship and disappointment in life and spiritual and moral failure, all of those live permanently showing their correct side. That's Tchias HaMesim. Of course, this has to be. The deep reason it has to be this way is because if things in the world could be broken and never fixed, the world would never manifest an absolute unity. Every aspect of the world has to show its divine and infinite connection. Therefore, nothing can remain broken permanently. So Hashem came into the world and he showed him, "You think clothing is only to hide your nakedness? I'm going to show you that now you must use that sign of your humiliation to show your dignity." And he sewed him beautiful garments. Why do we wear dignified? Why is there a Jewish idea to wear dignified clothes? Because when you wear clothes of refinement and dignity, you are doing two things with your clothing. One is you are hiding the nakedness of the body. And secondly, you're revealing its dignity. When a king wears royal garments, the garments do two things. One is they hide the body of the king, but they show that he's a king. That's why there's so many laws relating to clothes. In the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan says, "Mane mechab." He referred to his garments as his dignity, his honor. They give you honor by hiding your animal nakedness and by revealing. This is also why we are so fussy about women's modesty and about men's and women's modesty in clothing. If you use clothes only to accentuate the provocative nature of the body, it's worse than not having clothes. But if you use clothes to show the refinement and dignity of the body, and that's why there are so many laws about the modesty of garments and the dignity and the cleanliness of garments. And by the way, that's why in our pre-messianic age, people don't care about clothes anymore. Because as the world moves into greater disharmony and chaos, and less spiritual values. Clothes have become less and less important. It's an amazing thing. You know, if you go back and you examine the history, there's no better place to talk about it than in England. Right? You go back 50 years in this country, certainly 60 years, people wouldn't appear in public unless they were decently dressed. A businessman wouldn't walk in the street unless he had his hat, waistcoat, like suit. You couldn't go to a restaurant in this country without a jacket and tie. You weren't allowed into a restaurant. They didn't want your money unless you wore a jacket and tie. But today, that's completely irrelevant. Today, people go to the opera in their pajamas. You know what I mean? Yeah, a baggy thing we're advertising somebody's beer. Nobody wears a hat anymore. The hat is the most important part of the garments, because that shows only dignity. Shoes are not there for dignity. Shoes are so you can walk. These things are not here for dignity. This is when you look like a monkey. The lower garments on the body are more for covering and less for dignity. The higher parts of the body are clothed more for dignity than for nakedness. Wearing a garment on the head is purely a sign of dignity. Today it's completely irrelevant. The nature of garments is this. You know, the Hebrew word beged, which means a garment, means treachery. The same word in Hebrew that means a garment means a traitor. The old English word for a traitor was a turncoat. That was the old English word for a traitor. Actually, it's very interesting. An outer garment, a beged is a garment in Hebrew. An overcoat in Hebrew is called a me'il. A me'il is an outer garment. It also means treachery. You know that? The word me'ilah in Hebrew, the verb, means to take something sacred and use it for the profane. To betray sanctity and take it out. Me'ilah means when you go into the temple and you take something holy and you take it outside and use it in the profane world. That's the same idea again. By the way, you know the word beged means a vessel. You know that if you take the Aleph base in Hebrew, it goes Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, etc. The Aleph is always the letter of the lights and the spirit. Aleph is always a spiritual letter. That's why Aleph has no sound. It's the only letter that is silent in Hebrew, because it's the letter of the spirit. The verb Aleph in Hebrew means to elevate spiritually, right? Aluf. Aluf is the Hebrew, the highest rank. Aleph is the highest number in Hebrew, right? La Aleph in Hebrew means to teach or elevate. It's very likely that the English words elevate and aluf, and maybe elephant, come from aleph and aleph. It's possible. It's possible. There's a theory that English can be traced back to its Hebrew roots. But the aleph is always a spiritual letter. After you've got the lights, you build a vessel. What are the next three letters in Hebrew? Bet, gimel, dalet, beged. That's how the aleph base works. The aleph is the spiritual letter. The next three letters in sequence are the garment that are there to house the light. So when man was created originally, he didn't need clothing. The reason is that the garments of his body was so perfectly harmonized with the soul. There was no shame. The outside revealed the inside. In fact, the outside revealed the inside so perfectly you hardly saw the body. If you want an image, I would say, just as a raw, as a very coarse and rough metaphor, if you want to picture what Adam must have looked like, first of all, you know he was the size of the universe. When he was created originally, he was the size of the universe. That's why the universe is the size it is, because he occupied it all. But his body was diaphanous and incandescent. If you want a picture of it, I would say it's something like, if you look at a person now, you see only the body. You look at a person, you see only the body. You see a soul? No. If you look at a person very carefully, you can make out the wisp of a glow on the face, which represents the soul. It's called the ziva upon him. Somebody of great spiritual refinement, you can see it but more easily. It's that thing you see on the face, and a moment before death, it's there. A moment after death, you see it's not there anymore. That's why the face needs no clothing, by the way. Why don't we clothe the face? Because the face is spiritual enough that it carries a vestige of the original light. The eyes especially. That's why even where there is a clothing for the face, in some way, the eyes are always... The face in Hebrew means, the word in Hebrew for face is panim. Panim means the face, meaning the outer face. But it's the same Hebrew word as pnim, meaning the inside. The eye, by the way, Hebrew word ayin, always means a place of revealing depth. The Hebrew word ayin, the same word in Hebrew, means a wellspring, a spring of underground water. In Hebrew, the word al-ein hamayim, ma'ayan, what does it mean? A place where hidden underground water breaks the surface and you can see it. That's what the eye is. The eye is the place that reveals the depth. It's no accident that the Talmud says that the eye is connected to the heart. Right? You look at a body, you look at a person, you see only the body. The only place you see a suggestion of soul is a very, very faint remnant. Adam was exactly the opposite. When you looked at him, all you could see was the soul. And if you looked very carefully, you could make out the wispy outline of a body. If you imagine looking at a 1,000-watt electric bulb, you can only see the light, you can't see the glass. If you look very carefully, you might make out the glass. He was exactly the opposite of the way we are. Why? Because he was built in such a way that the vessel was only a vessel. The body wasn't there to speak for itself. The body was there to carry the soul. Right? Anytime you have a vessel or a medium containing a message, a successful, there's a rule in life, a successful medium is never seen. A very beautiful painting. You shouldn't see the paint. You should see what it's telling you. A beautiful piece of music. You shouldn't be hearing the sound, the note. You should be hearing the music. A beautiful person. You shouldn't be seeing the flesh. You should be seeing the soul emanate. Even in technology, let's bring it right down to the absolutely ridiculous. You have a computer. The computer has a thing called a graphic user interface, a screen. You don't want to see the screen. A bad screen is one where you see the screen. A good screen is where you see what it's showing you. You don't want to see the medium. You want to see what it projects. When you look at a human face, you're not supposed to be looking at a nose. And you're supposed to be, there's a person emanating from there. And that's how Adam was constructed. The body didn't interfere. It revealed. You know how the Talmud puts it? He was clothed in garments of light. He wore what's called kosmos or. He wore garments of light. What does that mean? You know, nothing in Torah is mere poetry. To be clothed in garments of light means to be manifest in a way that reveals and doesn't hide. To be the garment of light means to be presented in a medium that reveals you. Nothing would have been sillier than clothing. Light is the medium of revelation. So he wore garments of light. His body shone with his soul. After the sin, he was given garments of very similar word in Hebrew. Or means light, with an aleph. Or with an ayin means skin. There's a rule in Hebrew, we haven't got time now to go into it fully, but there's a rule in Hebrew that when an aleph becomes an ayin, it represents a fall from the spiritual to the physical. Aleph is the only silent letter in Hebrew, has no sound at all. Ayin begins to have a sound, it's one of the five guttural letters. People who pronounce Hebrew correctly, you can begin to hear the ayin. When an aleph becomes an ayin, make a list for yourself of Hebrew words that are spelt with an aleph and spell them with an ayin, and you'll see the transition. I'll give you an easy example. Aleph Yud Nun in Hebrew means nothing is revealed. Aleph Yud Nun, Ein. Right? Like Ein Sof means you can't see the end, something endless. Ein means is not revealed. Write it with an ayin and you get the ah, which does reveal. The tool that brings a thing into revelation, brings it down into manifestation. Whenever you take an aleph in Hebrew and you transpose it for an ayin, the word that you result is a physical. Man was originally clothed in garments of aleph vav resh or, and after the sin, God clothed him in garments of ayin vav resh or. What does ayin vav resh mean? Skin. Or means skin. But if you spell it out, ayin vav resh spells blind. Iver, the same word in Hebrew. First he was clothed in garments that revealed him. Now he's clothed in garments that make, you know, in English they call this a hide. Why is this called a thick? You have a thick hide. Where did they get the word hide from? The concept is that first it was a reveal. Now it's a hide. That's where it comes from. So that, and when that happened to man, the shame was such that he needed to cover that in a way that showed his dignity. The rule is, you take the problem and you use it for the solution. Now we take the outer layers that reflect our humiliation and we use them as best we can to show our dignity. There'll be a time when that won't be necessary. The Talmud has a discussion. Will the dead be resurrected with their clothes on or with their clothes off? Interesting discussion. What was the result? The result of the sin was that man was cast into a disparity, into a dichotomy, where his soul was perfect, and his body was very humiliatingly animal. What's the solution? So, you have to hear this well. The world's resolution of this problem from that time to this has been the body is irredeemable. And therefore, the only possibility for spirituality is to beat the body into submission. You have to become a celibate and an ascetic. Don't stimulate the body at all. Any sensual stimulation of the body is evil. It'll bring you down into the animal. If you're serious about spirituality, you don't drink wine. If you're really serious, you don't get married. Because marriage has a sensual component that is the most disastrous. Think about it. Take any religion or cult on earth. And think about it, Christianity, for example. Christianity is fraught with guilt about marital intimacy. On the one hand, they call it holy matrimony. But if you're serious about holiness, you have to become a monk or a nun. The reason is there's a real problem. There is a real problem. It is very hard to engage the lower aspects of the body and remain angelic. They're not being frivolous. It's a serious problem. Muslims, in Islam, you're not allowed to own alcohol. Not drink. You're not allowed to own alcohol. Why? Because they are very well aware that alcohol brings out the bodily and banishes the mind. If you have enough of that substance, there's no mind left. The halacha on Purim is you have to drink until you don't know the difference. That's what drinking, if you use it sensitively, it liberates the mind. Alcohol can tremendously liberate. The Talmud says when wine goes in, the secret begins to manifest. Nichnas yayin, yayin in Hebrew adds up to 70. Yatsa sod, the secret which adds up to 70, comes out. Right? Doesn't only mean, you know, you tell your secrets. It means that the inner dimension is revealed. But you use it too much, you banish the mind to the extent that you become part of the scenery. That's what alcohol can do. And the world has an immense problem with it. In Islam, you're not allowed to own it. If you're a Mormon, you're not allowed to drink coffee. You know that? A Mormon, you're not allowed to drink coffee or tea or Coke. I mean Coca-Cola. I don't mean... Because they stimulate... What's wrong with that? What's wrong with stimulating? It's very dangerous. Start getting the body buzzing. Who knows where you'll end up? Or down. These are not idiots. These are people with deep perception of the world. It's a real problem. In the Far Eastern religions, it's exactly the same. In Hinduism, the body is considered a concession. Marriage is considered a concession. Yes, it can be used in a tantric way. There's a whole discussion about it, but it's a concession. Much better to be able to do those things spiritually. Buddhists, for example. Buddhists have a very ascetic path. In Zen Buddhism, there is a pathway called the householder's pathway, where they get married. But even then, they have frequent retreats in celibate loneliness. Because the body brings you down. I'm not aware of another sect or cult or religion on earth that allows engaging of the body. Judaism, we use the body the whole time. Wine, for example. We do everything with wine. We take wine always. You know what we do in Judaism? Whenever we want to connect the problematic, lecherous, animal, physical with the elevated spiritual, we take a cup of wine. You know, we're so used to it as Jews, we don't even realize it. But it's very bizarre. Very bizarre. Imagine you're a Muslim. Or somebody who comes from one of these traditions where any sensual development is considered anti-spiritual. And you come into the Jewish community, what will you see? A circumcision. What's a circumcision? You take the most sensual aspect of the human being and put it through a procedure that enables it to have sanctity. And we take a cup of... What does wine have to do with circumcision? Everything. Because wine is the tool of showing the correct connection. The Gaon of Vilna says that wine is the only substance known that doesn't obey the rules of the physical, but it obeys the rules of the spiritual. You know that all physical things get worse with time. All physical things, the human body, machinery, everything physical gets worse with time. Spiritual things get better with time, like wisdom and judgment. Wine is the only class of substances that's physical that gets better with time. It's your key to insight into the spiritual world. So every time we want to take the physical and give it a spiritual component, we take a cup of wine. Marriage. Two people are getting married. On the one hand, it is a holy thing. On the other hand, it can be very sordid when man and woman get together. There's a cup of wine. Shabbos, where the mundane physicality of the week moves into the elevated dimension of Shabbos. You take a cup of wine. By the way, Havdalah is even more than that. Havdalah Saturday night is where Shabbos comes down into the week to spiral up higher next week than it was the week before. It's another connection of physical and spiritual. So every time we're using this, in the non-Jewish world, that's... In the non-Jewish world, there's not a country where you can buy a drink unless you're at least 18. Some places you have to be 21. 21. You can drive a lethal weapon when you're 16. But you can't drink a beer In Judaism, the kid's 8 days old, we put wine in his mouth. We have no problem with it. We grow up in it. It's part of what we do. It's very significant. The original fruit that Adam ate was a grape, according to one opinion in the Talmud. The one thing it for sure was an apple. Definitely wasn't. It was a grape. There is other possibilities. When Noah survived the flood, he planted grapes. First thing he did was grow wine. It was problematic. He should have planted wheat. You know what the Talmud says? That wine was created to comfort mourners. Know what that means? A mourner is shrunken into a limited world. And wine expands your world. Doesn't mean it makes you forgetful. The last thing that comforts a mourner is making you forgetful. That's a deep pain. Doesn't make you forgetful. It expands the consciousness. A mourner is shrunken in. That's why when you visit a mourner, you're not allowed to speak. You have to sit there to draw him out. And therefore, here's the pattern. The world decided that when man fell, the only solution was to banish the body. If you're serious about being spiritual, beat the body down. Become a celibate, an ascetic, sit on a mountaintop, pray, meditate, wear rough clothing, don't go near women, wine, sensual pleasures, they will bring you down. And Judaism is exactly the opposite. The single unique contribution that Abraham made to the world, Avram, he didn't bring spirituality to the world, that was there already. Shem and Eva were teaching Torah already. He brought to the world a unique concept. The concept is that if you want to get back to your spiritual height, you've got to go down into the animal and lift that up. Obviously, how will you reach? The deepest Jewish concept is the oneness of Hashem. Oneness means that everything has to be united. Not that you leave the physical behind and just regard it as discarded and dispensable. You have to bring it back to where it was before. And the rest of the world said to him, that's hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. You try and engage the body, you'll become an animal. And he said, you're right, it's dangerous, but we have to do it. And where we parted company with the rest of the world spiritually is that they all decided that to reach spirituality, you know where you even hear an echo of this, when Yitzchak blessed Yaakov and Esav, when Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, when he blessed Esav, the father of the non-Jewish nations, he said that you will have the fat of the land, v'tal ha-shamayim me'al, and the dew of the heaven will be above. You live in a dimension where the fat of the land is here and the dew of heaven's above. You want to reach that, you have to leave this. But when he blessed Yaakov, he said, you will have mital ha-shamayim u'mishmanei ha-aretz. You will live in a world where the dew of heaven and the fat of the land are mingled. That has to be your path. And we as Jews, we have the very difficult process of having to descend into the animal and the lecherous and the material and the physical and remain angels there. The whole idea of Hasidism, the whole Hasidic idea, is that the lower it is, the more potential it has for holiness. The darker the zone, the more potential for animal. This is why the most fallen aspect of the human being is the same mechanism that brings life to the world. There's nothing higher than bringing a new life to the world. And it's done in the most potentially sordid and inexpressibly animal fashion. The Kuzari says it's absurd. You can't go into detail. It's an absurdity. And that's Judaism. Marriage is called Kiddushin. Marriage in Judaism is called sanctification. The same area that the non-Jewish world uses as its curses and swear words, in Judaism is called sanctification. Of course, it requires modesty and hiddenness. There's a way to handle these things, of course. They're dangerous, no question. But that's what the Jewish idea is. And that's the concept. The concept on the Shema Yisera means that on Shabbos, when you reach more holiness, it doesn't mean you float higher. It means the spirit comes lower. The reason you can eat more on Shabbos is because this day of sanctity invites the soul into the body more. During the week, you shouldn't eat as much. It's dangerous. You should eat as much as you need. You should never eat one piece more, one drop more than you need. Because as soon as you start eating for pleasure, then you sink into the inappropriate use of the physical. On Shabbos, you can eat more. Shabbos has the capacity for the physical to manifest more spiritually. So on Shabbos, you can sleep more, you can eat more. It's a good time for husband and wife to be together. Why? Because this is a day that has more sanctity, and therefore the body tolerates more without being pulled down. Neshama Yisera means that the soul goes more into the body. Nishmas Kol Chai means that on this day, the same organs that are so limited that if you gave us them at their universal expansion, they'd be irrelevant. On this day, they can do the job of meeting infinity. Because this is a day when the power of the spirit is so united with the body. Where does this come from? Why is Shabbos like that? What is Shabbat? Shabbos is what we call Me'en Olam Haba. It's a premonition of the world to come. The world to come. On Shabbos, you have a 60th of an experience of what the world to come is. So you live in a dimension of the next world. What is the next world? What is the next world? So many systems, religions, misinformed Jews, they think the next world is some sort of spiritual zone where you float, I don't know, clouds maybe, you know. Our concept of the next world is that it's a reconnection of spirit and body. Our vision of the next world is that the lights are again in the vessels. That's called Tchias HaMaisim. The resurrection of the dead is the Messianic age will have two versions of resurrection. First will be one version of dead bodies being resurrected. 210 or 214 years later will be a second one. Until eventually everything's resurrected. Tchias HaMaisim doesn't mean that dead bodies simply get out of their graves. You know, the childish, very childish concept, Tchias HaMaisim, the Messianic age will dawn. Well, you'll be sitting there in the glorious sunshine, just outside the fence of the cemetery, and suddenly you'll hear kind of a vibration. See a grave open, a few bailing bones will reassemble, shake themselves off. And they carry on. There's another party tonight, and another argument with the neighbors tomorrow, you know. It's not Tchias HaMaisim. Tchias HaMaisim means that all that died is reconstituted. All elements of spiritual purpose are put back into their vessels. How else can they manifest? Our long-term vision of the world to come is a soul in a body again. To be sure, the body will be very elevated, much higher than now. There'll be no excretion. The body won't smell bad. It won't contain excrement. It'll be a very elevated body. It will be such an elevated body, it will look like a light. But it'll still be a vessel. You know, there's a famous argument between the Rambam and all his contemporaries. The Rambam says that the next world has no body at all. No body, it's only spiritual. When the Torah says that the tzaddikim, the righteous people, will be sitting and enjoying meals, great feasts and so forth, it's all metaphor, says the Rambam. Everyone else says that's wrong. The next world will be a soul in a body. In these things, there are no arguments. What the Rambam means is, of course there will be a soul in a body, but you call that a body. There will be a light in a vessel, but the vessel will be more light than the light is now. That can't be called a body. And the others say, no, that's called a body. It's a very subtle and refined argument. Everybody agrees that in the final revelation, there will be a light of the soul in a vessel called the body. The body will be very elevated. It will look more than angelic. The angels will be looking up to us. But it will be lights in vessels. It must be that way. The reason you are who you are is because you have your unique vessel. That's what makes you unique. If you didn't have a vessel, you'd be part of the original oneness. You wouldn't be you to receive reward. And therefore, the long-term prospect, the final end result of this life, is called the world to come, and the essence of that world is a resurrection. It's a Tchias HaMaisim, which is where soul and body are invested correctly. So what do you experience on Shabbos? On Shabbos, you experience a foretaste, a premonition of Tchias HaMaisim, where the ultimate light will be put back into an ultimate vessel, where the two are recombined. So on Shabbos, you can live in your body comfortably. The rest of the week you should be uncomfortable. You should not allow the body too much pleasure. Definitely not. It's dangerous. But on Shabbos we're eating as a mitzvah. By the way, the word mitzvah means to connect the two. The word mitzvah means a connection. It doesn't mean commandment. The word tzivuy in Hebrew means commandment. Mitzvah means where two things join, like tzevet, or betzavta chada means in one bond. And did you notice that all the mitzvahs are physical actions? Of all 613 mitzvahs, I challenge you to find me three or four that are not physical actions. Physical actions? This is a spiritual system. How are you going to achieve spirituality by physical actions? Every part of the body is involved in a mitzvah. That's exactly what a mitzvah is. A mitzvah means take a part of the body and do an action with it in the finite and physical world that connects you to the one who commands. You provide a vessel for the light that way. He is the light and the instruction, and you are the cutting edge that carries it out in the world. Therefore, mitzvahs are physical actions. Abraham didn't bring to the world Torah. Torah was in the world. He brought mitzvah to the world, the sense of expression of a spiritual thing in a physical action. The non-Jewish concept is the last thing you want is a physical action. Get above that. Leave it behind. The non-Jewish world has a concept that the body is so irredeemable that you can let it do whatever you want. You know, on the dark side, on the positive side, the teaching is asceticism. Beat the body into submission. On the dark side is let the body do whatever it wants, as long as your mind's okay. You know, we saw that in Bilam. Bilam was the greatest prophet the non-Jews ever had. The greatest prophet, as great as Moses in some ways. The Talmud says that his physical expression in the world was unrepeatable. Just to give you one example, the Talmud says he married his donkey. I'm putting it refined. He had a female donkey. The great tzaddikim rode male donkeys. It says by Abraham and by Moshe and the Mashiach, they rode a white donkey. The Hebrew word chamor in Hebrew means a donkey. The same word means materialism. Chamor in Hebrew means a donkey. It's the most material of all animals. It's only material. Donkey has no mind, no spirit. So when the Torah says that he rode a donkey, when Avraham Avinu went to perform the greatest act of his life with his son Yitzhak, right? Going up the mountain. So the Torah tells you, how did he go? He saddled his donkey. Who cares how he got there? The symbolism is, when a great righteous man rides a donkey, it means he's in control of purified materialism. And it is his vehicle, that's all. The Messiah will arrive on a donkey. Who cares how he comes? Get him here on the Concorde, you know. It doesn't matter how he gets him. The Torah is telling you he will manifest in control of purified materialism. He will manifest riding a vessel of the material world in control. When it comes to Bilam, he has a female donkey. He couldn't get above it. He was meshed with it. He couldn't get into, and he was the highest prophet who ever lived. What's going on? Because his theory was, what's the one got to do with the other? The body's fallen and hopeless anyway. Let it do whatever it wants. One great famous non-Jewish philosopher. One of the most famous. Famous for teaching moral philosophy. One morning his students found him crawling out of a house of very ill repute. Very ill repute. So the students said to him, Master, how could you behave like that? You're such a great moral philosopher and you behave like that? He said to them, does a mathematician have to be a triangle? What does moral teaching have to do with behavior? One is theoretical in the world of the mind, the other is the body. The body's hopeless anyway. How can you redeem a body that smells bad, contains excrement, behaves like an animal? How can you redeem it? It's hopeless. And as Jews, that's exactly what we have to do. Amazing thing. Amazing thing. You know, when you read Musa books, they tell you how to become a spiritual person. There's always a chapter on prishus. Prishus means how to stay away from the physical. Prishut, you have to stay away. You have to fast and stay away from the physical and not eat more than you need. And yet Judaism is all about engaging the physical. What does that mean? It means that you have to engage the physical only for the purpose of the spiritual. Anytime you engage the physical for the sake of the physical, you've fallen prey to exactly what they're worried about out there and they're right about. And therefore the secret is, of course we use the physical, but only as a vehicle for the spiritual. And it takes practice, that's why you have to fast as well. You can eat rich foods and use them for spirituality only when you can not eat them. The Mishnah says if you want to learn Torah, you have to be able to sleep on the floor. It says, you have to sleep on the floor, eat bread, plain bread and water by measure. That's all you're allowed. You want to become a Torah person? You've got to sleep on the floor, eat bread and drink water by measure. That's all. Bread, maybe a little salt. That's all. Great sages have not done that. The meaning of the Mishnah is you have to be able to eat bread with salt, water by measure, and sleep on the floor, and it makes no difference to you. If it makes no difference to you, if you're perfectly satisfied with bread and salt and sleeping on the floor and water, then you can eat fatted duck. But as soon as you can't do with less than fatted duck, there's no hope for you. Once you can get away, once you can control yourself, so that you don't need the physicality, then you can use the physicality. So of course there's a process of fasting. Of course you have to learn to do that. You can only enjoy Purim if you can handle Yom Kippur. You feast on Purim and you drink on Purim if you can handle Yom Kippur. That's fine. If you can't, if you can only handle the one, you know in your spirituality. And therefore the correct procedure is using the physical world, but very cautiously. Very dangerous world. Shabbos you can be a little less cautious. When it's a mitzvah, when you're eating for a mitzvah, engaging the body in a mitzvah, even then it's dangerous. It has to be handled correctly. And therefore, in summary, what we learned this evening, it's a long discussion, obviously, we're just beginning. But the theme is, that's what's unique about the Jewish pathway, is a reunification of the world. A tying back or a stitching back together a torn world. Which torn world? The world of spirit and body. You know, in Shir HaShirim it says we have a young sister. I'll finish with this. It says, Achos lanu ketana, we have a young sister. Achot lanu ketana, we have a young sister. This is the story of the Jewish people. We have a young sister. So the Midrash says, our young sister was Avraham Avinu Abraham. Why? She'iche esakera, because he stitched a torn world together. He stitched together. The word achot in Hebrew, sister, means stitching. The Hebrew word for brother or sister means the act of stitching. You know, if you take something that is whole and rip it, and then you stitch it together, that verb in Hebrew is la'ache. La'ache takera means to stitch the tear. Why are brothers and sisters called the same word as stitching? Because brothers or brother and sister are two separate people who were once one in the body of a parent. They were once one. They were born from the same source as two different people in the world. So they have a unique relationship that's a stitched. Yeah. By the way, this man who is called the agent who stitched the world together, reunited God with the world, put the spirit back into the earth, put the light back into the vessel, began an obsession with the oneness of reunification, of bringing perfection and oneness to the world. He called his wife his sister. Amazing thing. Abraham, he goes into Egypt. He goes into Egypt, which is the cesspool of the world, the most sensually depraved part of the world. The Torah calls it Arvasa Aretz, the nakedness of the world. And as he moves into that zone of depravity, he says to his wife, tell them you're my sister. What's going on? The simple meaning is practical, political. They kill him. They thought it was his wife. The deep meaning is a spiritual person should always think of his wife as his sister. What is a man's wife? The two of them were once one in the spiritual world. The Talmud says Adam and Eve were fused at the back before they were torn apart and brought face to face to mesh back into each other through their own effort. That's what Bashiach really means. So husband and wife are one creature in the spiritual world. They are one being, a male face and a female face. They are split apart, torn apart, and brought back into the world to stitch themselves together. So a spiritually sensitive person knows that his wife is his sister. That means a person with whom it's possible to reunify what was once one. So therefore this great sage whose obsession is reunifying the world, he's called the young sister of the Jewish people, he calls his wife his sister. That's the deep meaning. And therefore he brought a teaching to the world that we have to now fulfill mitzvahs. Avraham spells 248, the number of positive mitzvahs in the Torah. And that's what he brought to the world. And therefore that's the Jewish process, is the reunification of a split world. There's no better time for that than Shabbos. Shabbat is the time when this world and the next world unite, where the work of the world is done and you experience the dimension of reward. It's a premonition not only of a world to come, but of a Tchias HaMesim. In that dimension, when body and soul are again reunited, that's what one should experience on Shabbos. And if on Shabbos one should be able to eat and feel the spiritual meaning of the food, one should be able to rest and enjoy more of a physicality. There's more pleasure that should be experienced on Shabbos. One should eat more. And yet that should not bring one down, but give one a sense of elevation. And we carry that out into the week. When we eat together, why do we eat together? I said that was the last thing, but this is the last thing. Eating is the activity that connects two together. Eating keeps the light in the vessel. When you eat, the soul stays in the body. If you don't eat, the two separate. Eating is and that's why people eat together. And when Jews eat together, three people eat together, we start making a unique blessing. And if 2 or 10 Jews eat together, we use Hashem's name. Because eating is always a manifestation of connection. Male-female intimacy, the Torah euphemistically refers to as eating. Right? Where two are united, genuinely. And therefore, when people eat together, there's a sense of unity as well. And on Shabbos, a time for that. And therefore, that's the concept. Nishmas Kol Chai means the soul. It's a tefillah of Shabbos because it's referring to the Neshama Yesera. That's the day on which the finite can, as it were, can take off and reach into the infinite. Okay, we'll stop there.